Justice Cates, as you know, joined the Supreme Court in January. Her husband, Howard Beckerman's here, and his stepdaughter, Shayna. Shayna, how are you? Like, glad to come in and see your stepmom in action here in court, you know, at the appellate court. So welcome to the Supreme Court. We're glad to have you here today. Like that. Okay, we'll go ahead and call our first case, which is case number 70504, Nadler versus United Automobile Insurance Company. We have Mr. Prince representing the appellant, Mr. Paulsenberg representing the respondent. Mr. Prince, did you want to reserve any time in rebuttal?
Chief Justice Gibbons, thank you. Yes, I'll reserve 3 minutes for the rebuttal time period.
Okay, very well. Then we'll go ahead and proceed.
All right. Chief Justice, if it pleases the court, my voice sounds a little spotty. I just completed a three-week trial and did an oral closing argument and rebuttal argument literally 15 minutes ago, so if my voice is a little spotty, I apologize in advance. When a timely action on a judgment is filed, no renewal is necessary under NRS 17.140. The purpose of initiating an action against UIC was solely for the purpose of satisfying the underlying default judgment, which was entered in state court in 2008. When a judgment creditor like Cheyenne Nolder obtains a judgment against a tortfeasor, under Nevada law, they now have a direct action against a liability insurer to collect the indemnity benefits available under that policy. And if an additional agreements are reached between the tortfeasor and the injured claimant, may be able to entitle to recover additional rights. And so in Nevada, the mechanism from which to enforce a judgment against an insurer under the Hull leasing case is by an action against the liability insurer. Here, if the broadest characterization of reviewing the complaint filed in 2009 against UAC is clearly for the purposes of enforcing the underlying default judgment against them. What's important to point out, in February 2015, as a result of the federal district court's determination
But the default judgment was not against the insurance company.
That's correct. It was not.
So you just elided that point by saying that this suit was to enforce the default judgment.
That's correct. I am. And I believe even though they weren't a direct party to that action, they had the ability to participate, chose not to participate. But even assuming hypothetically, Justice Pickering, they had chosen to participate and provide a defense, they would have in fact been involved. And regardless of their participation, they still have an indemnity obligation owed to their policyholder, Mr. Lewis, to pay out the policy limits. At least in the context when there's liability insurance in place, or there is a party who has an indemnity obligation, i.e. an indemnitor, like an insurer, a direct action against them is the mechanism by which you would enforce the judgment. They have, for example, in this court's decision in Andrew, you determine as a result of, which has an implication here, in this case, once an insurer breaches the duty to defend, this court determined that a liability insurer may be bound by the entry of a default judgment and financially responsible for payment and satisfaction of that judgment. The practical reality is this. Once a liability insurer makes a payment, for example, when UAIC paid, and this is at Appendix 14 and 15 of the appellant's appendix, they paid the $15,000 policy limits on that date. It's significant for two reasons. Number one, that would have the effect of reducing the underlying $3.5 million default judgment. If UAC were to have, let's say, a $5 million judgment entered against them in this case, $3.5 million plus any additional interest or other obligation would first have to go and satisfy the underlying judgment against Mr. Lewis. That's the function and purpose of this. Moreover, if they were to pay any settlement amount, I'm certain that they would want to extinguish the underlying judgment. And the reason why that's important is because otherwise you could potentially have a double recovery. If UAC was required to pay the $3.5 million in this case, and then that left the ability to still collect on the $3.5 million in the underlying case, that would result in some type of double recovery. The satisfaction.
There's no way to recover. Let me strike that because there's a lot of collateral stuff that in a certified question context is really difficult for us to, I mean, we can't get into that, all of that.
True.
But Mr. Lewis has a judgment by Mr. Nolder against Mr. Lewis. That judgment was not renewed and it expired under Nevada law, correct?
Respectfully, no, I don't believe it expired. I think the one of two options exists under NRS 11.190. If you timely, within 6 years, initiate an action on the judgment, which as a judgment creditor, the Nalders have that ability.
I understand that's question one.
Then no renewal was necessary. You don't even reach the 17.
But it was not renewed under Nevada law. I misspoke, and that's a fair point. The first one is the legal issue that remains in this case.
Correct.
The second one is he did not renew it under 17.214 or whatever it is.
Correct.
That's what we're talking about is the first question.
That's correct. There was no effort to renew the judgment under 17.140. We believe that
and the action, Mr. Lewis was not a defendant to the suit by Mr. Nalder against that underlie that is in the Ninth Circuit that comes over here.
He is a plaintiff in that case, right, which is this case. Mr. Lewis, in addition
to... So how did they ever try to renew the judgment against Mr. Lewis?
Mr. Lewis, they did not. So there's no steps taken to renew as of this point. However, we
then
believe...
Then how is this a suit on the judgment against Mr. Lewis? It's not.
This act, I believe, by reason of the direct action as a result of the assignment of rights, as well as by operation of law, the Nalders had the legal ability to sue UASC directly. They did not have that ability before being a judgment creditor. Once they enjoyed that status or received that status as a judgment creditor, they gained additional legal rights they would not otherwise have had. And as a result of that, the mechanism to sue an insurer, a liability insurer specifically, is to sue them directly under theories of breach of contract, bad faith, or otherwise, to seek satisfaction of the underlying judgment. That's exactly in part what this court faced in the Andrew decision, which is, we believe is dispositive question one in this case, but more importantly, the financial consequences to an insurer who fails to participate in an action. But even more than that, even if they had participated in the action by providing a defense, but elected not to settle when they had a reasonable chance to do so in the underlying case, the Nalders would still have the legal ability to sue them as a direct action by the Hall decision.
Even if it's not a bad faith breach, don't we have a finding from the federal court that this was not a breach of the duty, the breach of the duty to defend was not bad faith, it had to do with a renewal notice that was ambiguous?
Yes.
So you're under the Century Surety case on...
The first question.
Yes, the Douglas opinion of last...
December.
Yeah. So we don't have tortious bad faith, and you're saying you still have
yes.
a right of direct action notwithstanding that.
Once the Nalders got the judgment against Mr. Lewis on the one hand, that's the judgment that gives rights now in favor of the Nalders to sue directly UAIC. Once the Nalders became a judgment creditor of Mr. Lewis, now they had the legal ability to bring a direct action against UAIC. Justice Pickering, setting aside any breach of contract theory, any bad faith theory, they would have the ability to sue directly UAIC to at least in part sue to their policy limits. Let's assume it's just $15,000, to now bring an action to at least partially satisfy the judgment. So once they receive that legal right, which is a very valuable right for an injured claimant, because under the Gunning versus Allstate decision, you don't have any direct action until you have the judgment. Once you have the judgment, you're a judgment creditor. Those are very valuable rights in terms of the ability to pursue. It's also consistent with the at least for automobile liability insurers, consistent with their financial responsibility under Nevada law.
Is there another jurisdiction that has recognized this type of claim as a action on the judgment, so to speak?
Not that I've seen directly. There's been lots of discussions about what's an action on the judgment and collection efforts and potentially post-judgment discovery efforts in the form of judgment debtor exams or otherwise. Does that satisfy the action on the judgment requirement? But it's one of those issues that neither side has pointed to a case like that. I believe in part it's escaping review. It certainly hasn't happened with this court. But
when did Lewis assign Nalder his rights under the judgment?
Shortly after the judgment was entered in 2009.
Okay.
That was, excuse me, 2008.
Okay.
And then by the time the action was filed in 2009, which was removed to federal court.
So Lewis had signed Nalder Lewis's rights against the insurer.
In part, yes. But Mr. Lewis has also maintained his own rights to sue for damages above and beyond just the payment of the underlying judgment. Mr. Lewis is also, you know, I don't represent Mr. Lewis, I only represent the Nalders here. Mr. Christensen is handling that aspect of it. He is also, to my understanding, claiming damages similar to what happened in Allstate Miller for damages above and beyond the actual judgment amount. And so for those reasons, he's going to be pursuing his own damage claim. The Nalders have an interest in recovering the full amount of the judgment, plus any interest or cost that might be associated with just the principal judgment amount, which is the form of economic loss we're talking about, which you can recover under a breach of contract theory, under the Andrews decision. And so we also have, it's our position, we maintain that the action was timely filed, therefore no renewal was necessary. We believe that an action on the judgment needs to be construed sufficiently broad enough to make sure, like the Salibas case out of Florida, that if the main purpose of the action is to collect upon the underlying judgment, that satisfies an action on the judgment language. It can't be so tight as it has to be the same party. For example, let's assume you have you sue a general contractor and you get a judgment, but maybe they're insolvent. But there's an indemnity obligation owed by a subcontractor, an express indemnity obligation, very much similar to how an insurer would have to respond for, say, an absent defendant, or maybe the defendant corporation is gone, but there's still a liability insurance policy in place. If you could sue the subcontractor, seek to enforce the indemnity obligation, which would help in part satisfy your judgment. It's a very limited context in the sense, but as a liability insurer, given the unique position they occupy in society and their role of providing reparation benefits in the event of an injury and the obligation to indemnify, then that's why this court has recognized that you now have a direct action once there is a judgment. We believe that if by requiring a renewal would essentially negate the plain language of NRS 11.190, that it's in the disjunctive. You can either renew or file an action on the judgment, in which case here we filed an action on the judgment, therefore you don't even need to reach the renewal question at all. But if you did, we believe that we have two or three tolling arguments. I only have a short time left. I believe the most persuasive of those arguments is 11.200.
Think those are profitable.
I'm sorry?
I don't think it's profitable to pursue those because they're outside what was sent to us by the
If you don't believe that's covered by the question, we did handle it in the briefing. Our position remains that we timely filed an action. Therefore, you don't even need to reach the renewal question. We are only concerned with the court's language of when you certify the question that the judgment has expired. We were concerned about the feeling the judgment had expired. We believe that the action timely satisfied the requirements of 11.190.
Well, answer this. Could Nalder collect against Lewis?
Yes.
Alone?
Potentially, yes.
How?
Through the various mechanisms. This is one method of collection.
Against Lewis?
Yes. I think once they sued UASC directly, that is an effort to collect on the judgment because UASC has an indemnity obligation under a contract of liability insurance to Mr. Lewis. And that's what gives rights to both parties the ability to sue UASC.
So if they recorded the judgment, if Nalder had recorded the judgment against Lewis's real estate in Nevada, more than 6 years elapses, and then Nalder and Lewis sue the insurance company, your point is the lien would renew?
I'm saying the lien remains valid for all purposes. Once they filed an action against UAIC, that would be considered an action on the judgment, and that would satisfy all the time requirements for NRS 11.190.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Paulson, before you proceed, just a couple announcements I neglected to make at the beginning. As you can see, Justice Hardesty's attending by video from Carson City. The Supreme Court asked him to remain in Carson City today to take care of some other business on behalf of Court. Also, Justice Silver is not here today, but she will be participating in the decision and considering the audio record of it. She'll listen to that as well. Justice Perigary has recused from participating in the case. So with that, please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. I had assumed the court was in Las Vegas to avoid the legislature today. Good afternoon, Chief Justice Gibbons. May it please the court, Dan Paulsenberg for the respondent. This is a very messy case, but it can't be because it's a certified question. The court is, the Ninth Circuit is asking this court one general big question which this court has rephrased, and that is
so this, do you agree that Andrews answers the first of the two certified questions?
Century surety? No, I don't agree it does. I think it answers a big question, but I don't think it answers that question the way it applies to this case.
Yeah, I think it answers the legal question that you can, even if you don't have bad faith, if there's a breach of the duty to defend, you can get
consequential
damages over and above the sums.
And that's the big question I'm talking about. And Justice,
I understand you want to make factual arguments about that, but the legal proposition seems to me to be settled in that.
Yes. I mean, Justice Douglas said may several times
right.
in the opinion.
Absolutely.
And I think, yes, I do want to talk about the factual distinctions in this case, because I think this case is so different from Century Surety. Let me start there, since you asked. The Century Surety was a case that was footnote 4 of Justice Douglas's opinion. He says, essentially, you look at the four corners of the complaint and the policy to see if there is potentially coverage and therefore a duty to defend. In that circumstance, of course there was coverage. When this case was argued, when Century Surety was argued, I sat at that table, Dennis sat at this table, and I shook my head when the lawyer for the insurance company was saying, no, an insurance company can just refuse to defend. Now, Justice Douglas handles that in footnote 5. But that case was dealing with big abstract questions. Can you just say you don't have to defend? Is there the potential for consequential damages? In this case, there was no coverage. Looking at the complaint and looking at the policy, there was no coverage. Your Honor, we weren't dealing with an exclusion, and exclusions are rarely valid under Nevada law since the 80s.
Isn't the certified question literally the same as the certified question in the other case, like word for word?
Pretty close.
So why are we still talking about this?
Because I think the answer is different. I think this is a refinement of the answer in Century Surety, because we're looking at a situation where there isn't, on the face of the complaint and the policy, any coverage.
I think it's a refinement. Would be profitable to devote yourself to this.
Indeed, and I was going to cover that one last. So let me go to the judgment issue, because the question here really is, how good is a judgment, and how long is a judgment good? And to answer that question, we have to go back in time. We have to go back to the common law. And if you look at the Friedman decision from Arizona and the Mandelbaum decision from Nevada, you can see that under the common law, a judgment was good for a year and a half. No, a year and a day. Judgment was good for a year and a day. And to avoid that abrupt and rather cruel threshold, the common law also developed a procedure that you could bring a suit on the judgment and reduce the judgment to another judgment. And that way, you in effect renewed the judgment, but there wasn't actually a renewal. The legislature expanded the day, a year and a day, to 6 years in 11.190. But it still, you didn't have a situation where the judgment was good after that. We see that in a number of statutes. We see that in 21.010. You can get a writ of garnishment within the 6 years, but it is no good after the 6 years has expired. This court in Levin versus Frey talked about judgments expiring after the 6 years. The legislature then came up with another procedure under 17.214, which is you can renew the judgment. Now, the Mandelbaum decision doesn't talk about that statute at all. And in fact, what it says is when the legislature comes in and establishes a procedure, maybe that will change the common law on actions upon the judgment. In Arizona, the legislature, when they came up with a procedure to renew the judgment, actually also kept the idea of bringing an action on a judgment. When Nevada adopted 17.214, it did not. So although the 19th century, it was clear that we had an action upon a judgment, it is somewhat less clear that we still have that procedure now. But even assuming that we do, this isn't an action on a judgment. An action on a judgment is simply suing the defendant that you had in that case and getting another judgment based exclusively on the judgment in that case. It's a form of renewal, but it's not a renewal.
But why would anybody pursue that option?
I don't know why anybody would.
You just renew if you're going to have exactly.
Exactly. And once 17.214 was passed, I don't think anybody has followed that procedure. They're claiming now that this action against somebody entirely different that's trying to create liability on that other entity based in part a premise or a basis or, as we say in our brief, evidence of the liability is that judgment.
Well, wouldn't we be able to pursue an action on the judgment against, for example, an alter ego of your judgment debtor or a successor in interest to your judgment debtor who effectively you're saying they're responsible for the underlying judgment?
Or somebody who violated the Uniform Fraudulent Conveyances Act.
Okay.
Or the example that...
So it doesn't have to be the judgment debtor.
But that's not an action upon the judgment that would keep the judgment going. If you brought any of those actions, and that's the Ninth Circuit question, if you bring an action against somebody else based in part on a judgment and that judgment expires, do you still have the action against that somebody else? And we say you don't. The judgment has expired. It's no good. If they're suing for consequential damages to Mr. Lewis, there are no consequential damages to answer your question.
So your point is if there's, you would argue that if there's a fraudulent conveyance by a judgment debtor and you sue the person who got the money from the judgment debtor under the Fraudulent Conveyances Act, but you don't renew or sue the judgment debtor himself and the judgment goes past 6 years,
yes,
that you're out of luck.
Yes.
And you say that principle applies here.
Yes.
Why should that be the case?
Because there is finality in judgments. And our briefs all talk about both sides, about the legislature wanting to cut liability at 6 years. And in a way, that's true, but realize what the legislature was doing was expanding it out to 6 years. 6 years is not a harsh remedy. 6 years is very generous compared to the common law, which only allowed a judgment to be good for a year and a day.
Sure, but in this case, it's not like you have a judgment debtor who's going to be surprised that this is going on. The judgment debtor is actually participating in this other case that they're arguing is an action on the judgment. So does that policy even apply here?
Yes, I don't believe that the validity of the judgment depends on the judgment creditor knowing about the judgment.
But in the hypothetical of the Uniform Fraudulent Conveyance Act, if
yes,
you sued both the judgment debtor and the person to whom the judgment debtor transferred money or property, you would agree that would be an action on the judgment at that point?
No.
Okay.
If you're trying to sue, an action on a judgment, the common law action on a judgment or action upon a judgment is simply suing the same defendant to enter the same judgment again. That is what gives life to
and
the judgment.
And restart the shelf life of that judgment.
Yes.
Historically.
Just as if we renewed, although there's no reason to go through the procedure of bringing an action on a judgment to get a new identical judgment minus any offsets when you could simply do a renewal of the judgment. That's why I question whether this procedure still exists after the legislature passed 17.214.
What about interstate? I mean, I know there's the Uniform Interstate Enforcement of Judgments Act, but how does that factor in?
The Uniform Act on interstate judgments actually has two provisions in there. It provides that you can domesticate a foreign judgment. And then in one provision, it also sets out, instead of this, you can use the procedure to file on the judgment and get a new judgment in Nevada.
So that would be an action on the judgment or not?
That would be an action on the judgment. If you were suing, if you had a New York
a
judgment against me, and you sued me in Nevada to get a new Nevada judgment, that would be an action upon the judgment.
So the statute's not wholly without purpose.
You The uniform interstate judgment?
No, the
action upon a judgment.
Statute providing for action upon a judgment.
Well, realize 11.190 simply talks about what the statute of limitations is for that. And what it says is an action on a judgment from any state.
Right.
So it is not geared just to domestic judgments being renewed, although this court in Mandelbaum did read it that way. So, yes, let me assume for the sake.
I mean,
Excuse me?
I'm not sure that's correct. I mean, by its terms, it speaks to out-of-state judgments as well.
Well, it does speak to out-of-state judgments as well. It says any state or the United States. I have it over here. I didn't bring it up.
Yeah, any court of the United States or any state or territory.
Right. Although Mandelbaum, I'd love to make the argument, and tell you the truth, 2 weeks ago I was going to make the argument that statute doesn't even apply to domestic judgments and a judgment upon that. But Mandelbaum seems to say that it does. But remember, Mandelbaum was before the renewal process. So I'm not sure that Mandelbaum is good law.
So Mr. Pulsenberg, in your briefing, I think both sides mentioned the Fidelity National case from Arizona. Okay, right. So in this case, the Arizona Supreme Court says that the RICO claims against the judgment debtor are not an action on the judgment.
Right.
But it also cited to a prior Court of Appeals of Arizona case, Associated Aviation Underwriters from 2004, 98 Pacific 3rd, 572, which seems more similar to this case where it's collecting on liability against an insurer on an indemnity obligation. And the court there seemed to find that that was an action on the judgment. Have you read this case?
The case cited by the Friedman case, I do not recall it.
Okay.
Fidelity National.
Right. Fidelity cited it in footnote 5.
Okay. Well, there were a lot of decisions before the Friedman decision came down that went all over the place. So under Friedman, I don't think any action against anybody other than the judgment debtor, I said creditor earlier, I apologize, any action against anyone besides the judgment debtor would count as a common law action upon a judgment. I realize we're going back more than a century to try to figure out what this common law is, but I don't think this action is it. All the issues, Justice Pickering, you don't think we need to get to, and I would generally agree on a certified question because they'd be left to the federal district court. I don't think even the federal district court gets to the tolling provisions and such because this isn't an action upon a judgment. This court in Mandelbaum said that some tolling provisions apply to an action.
Let me interrupt you, though. What do you say to Mr. Prince's argument that they had a direct right of action against the insurance company, the Nodders, and therefore they don't need to, this suit is an action on the judgment?
Well, in fact, that defeats his argument. You don't have a direct cause of action, they're pointing out, until you reduce the obligation to a judgment. And then you can turn around, and notice he stresses that you could bring an action against the insurance company primarily for the policy limits. And yeah, absolutely you could. But that's not an action upon a judgment. That's kind of like a fraudulent conveyance action. That may be the basis of an action against the insurance company, or the evidence that you need to prove the action against the insurance company. But because it involves so much more, it is not an action upon a judgment.
So you would say not just that generally an action on a judgment is against a judgment debtor, you would say exclusively that's the only thing it can be.
I do know that the Friedman case used the word generally.
And it seems like that's been their wording in the little bit of other case law I've been able to
find. There's a difference between lawyers and judges. Lawyers like to argue in the absolute, and judges like to save a little cushion for the cases that may come. I cannot imagine a case where it wouldn't be against the same judgment debtor. But I would be comfortable if the opinion said generally, because there may be something we haven't thought of yet. Remember, theirs is the absolute argument. any action against the insurance company is going to be an action upon the judgment.
Mr. Polsmer, I'm going to give Mr. Prince another minute, so you have another minute as well.
Oh, and I had just wound up so perfectly. If there aren't any other questions, I don't think I need it.
Questions? Justice Hardesty and Carson, do you have any questions?
No, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
And I was ready for Justice Hardesty's questions because of Levin versus Fry. So
okay,
we'll save those for another day. Thank you, Ron.
Okay, could you add, Elizabeth, 1 minute to Mr. Prince's time?
Yes. Just to start where Mr. Polsenberg's argument began, I believe Andrew, since it's the identical question, is dispositive of that legal question. It had nothing to do with the facts of this particular case. You're asked to resolve a legal question initially by the Ninth Circuit, and then, because Andrews is also my case, once Melder was stayed, Judge Gordon certified the identical word-for-word question. It wasn't close. It was the identical wording, so I think you've resolved the legal issue. It'll be up to the Ninth Circuit for any further disposition of this case when it's remanded back. When you have a judgment and you became a judgment creditor, one way you can sue insurers and saying to the insurer, you have a duty to pay this judgment or to satisfy this judgment. Under the Hall leasing case, that gives you that legal ability. Using your example, Judge Justice Kadish, about what about if it's a successor interest? What happens if before or even after the entry of judgment, a corporation sells its assets and now you have a third entity out here, a new entity, who has not only bought assets but also assumed liabilities. You've liquidated your damages, the legal theory against the former entity, and now you're going to seek collection on the judgment against the successor entity. Similar would be to this person who received the transfer of the fraudulent assets or monies. You could say, Mr. Smith owed $100,000. Mr. Jones, you took the $100,000 improperly. We're asking you to satisfy this judgment. That is another mechanism. The indemnity obligation that I provided you and the contractor, subcontractor agreement, I think the law could be replete with examples. So if you draw too tight that it has to be the identical parties to the judgment, to an action on the judgment, I think it would lead to very absurd results and to a lot of abuse. I think from a policy perspective, I'm sorry?
May I pose a question? I'm sorry for interrupting you, Mr. Prince. The video causes that to happen, so please finish your thought and then I'll pose my question.
I think I'm ready for your question, Justice Hardesty.
Okay, great. So let's suppose that the court agreed with your position and treated the suit against the insurance company as an action upon a judgment. And the recovery here did not cover the full amount of the judgment. Would Lewis be liable for the balance? And what becomes of his ability to defend against a non-renewed judgment once you partially recover?
The answer is yes. I believe once the action is filed against UAIC, that satisfied the action on the judgment requirement for Mr. Lewis and the insurer, and therefore no renewal is required. If the insurer was only obligated to satisfy a portion of the judgment, Mr. Lewis would potentially be legally obligated to satisfy the balance through whatever means he could satisfy it. So, I don't know if he would have the ability to satisfy it, potentially option would still exist.
So under that analysis, Mr. Lewis, a non-party to the current case, would have a judgment renewed against him or her without having participated in the case that renewed the judgment. Is that your theory?
Respectfully, Mr. Lewis is a party to this case.
Okay.
He's actually seeking damages on behalf of himself for not only to seek satisfaction of the judgment, but damages for having to go through these years of legal proceedings and the effect on him, his financial losses, and on any other general damages he may recover, as I understand it.
To be fair, there is nothing that seeks a claim against Mr. Lewis to renew the judgment against Mr. Lewis.
There is no request to renew
a judgment against Mr. Lewis in the current action filed within the federal court at this point. That's correct.
To Justice Hardesty's point, from the standpoint of a claim against Mr. Lewis to renew the judgment, he might as well not be a party. That was the hypothetical I was trying to get to earlier when I was asking you the same question.
I believe it's our position, Justice Pickering, that once you file the action on the judge to recover against UAIC, that's an action on the judgment satisfying 11.190 for all purposes.
And so
that's one way you could satisfy a judgment against Mr. Lewis is the direct action against UAIC. That's one method.
But so Mr. Lewis gets past the 6 month or 6 year bar. He goes on about his business. Let's say he's not a plaintiff in this lawsuit.
Okay.
He thinks, I'm home free. This judgment is gone, even though it's a lien on his house.
Okay.
And then Nalder sues UAIC directly on a direct action.
Okay.
Your point is somehow the judgment against Lewis revives and so does the lien.
I wouldn't probably use the term revive. I believe it remained in legal effect. It remained continuously in legal effect once the action was filed against UAIC.
No, but what if there's a 2 year gap?
In our analysis, it wouldn't matter that this is one method of collection against Mr. Lewis, against UAIC. I guess for now it's helping him in the sense that they're not taking assets from him currently. This was one of Mr. Lewis's assets, and this is how the vehicle by which that the Daughters can sue to recover on the judgment to in part or wholly or fully satisfy the underlying judgment. Once it triggers the duty to pay, that gives rise to the legal ability. You don't even need to get to the renewal. Contrary to what Mr. Polsberg had to say, the legislature obviously had something different in mind. If they kept the language or maintained the language, you can either renew or have an action on the judgment. There's some legal effect they were giving to that language. While Mr. Polsberg may
think... Prince, I'll have to cut you off here. I think we understand your point.
Mr. Polsberg, thank you.
I am going to give you 2 minutes more because we kind of ran way over there with Justice Hardesty's question if you wish to use them.
Thank you, Your Honor. Justice Hardesty's question and Justice Pickering's hypothetical, I think, underscored the point. You could bring, under their theory, all I have to do is sue an insurance company, not have to sue Mr. Lewis, and it would somehow prolong or, I think, revive a judgment that had ceased to exist.
Suppose we were addressing this in a different context. Would a suit on a failed response on a writ of attachment or garnishment renew a judgment?
No. First of all, it's still not clear in Nevada whether the execution actions are considered an action, whether those proceedings are a separate action. So I don't think this court has ever answered whether that would be an action upon the judgment. And it is, so it's, with that answer, I don't think you can answer to the Ninth Circuit that yes, just suing somebody else keeps the cause of action against the insured alive. Let me address the hypothetical that Mr. Prince is using. He's talking about suing an indemnitor. No, that wouldn't be an action upon a judgment. If I indemnified somebody and you obtained a judgment against that other person and brought another action against me, the judgment against that person is just part of the case. You would still have to prove my duty and breach having to do with indemnity. So that would be much like this situation where that would not be an action upon a judgment because it is not, generally, against the judgment debtor. Last point, 11.190 does not say you have two options. You can bring a suit upon a judgment or renewal. What it says is you can bring a suit upon a judgment from any state within 6 years of the judgment or renewal. It's talking about you have 6 years from the renewal. It doesn't say that there are two other options.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Paulson.
Thank
and Mr.
You.
Prince. Again, we appreciate the Ninth Circuit letting us weigh in on this very important legal issue and the excellent arguments and briefs, as always, from both of you. We appreciate that as well. So the court will be in recess till 3 o'clock this afternoon.